PayPay.org.
Joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Hello, Charlene.
Hello, everybody. And it's not really spring here, but we're trying to get there.
Don't say it. Don't say it. And thanks to Aaron for being our podcaster, and also thank you, listeners. We also want to thank people who join our listener club. And if you would like to join our listener club, you can send me an email to disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. But tonight we have...
Yes, Mr. Kurt Jones from Battle Lake, Minnesota.
Thanks, Kurt, for joining us. We always love hearing from you. Kurt was on the show. If nobody remembers, everyone, of course, remembers Kurt. Don't worry. They all remember. was on the show with Tamarack, his band, that came on several times, actually. So that's been kind of fun. So I just want to thank you again for joining. And if you want to be on the listener member list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. So now for tonight's guest. Tonight, we have a double biller for you. This week, Alyssa Golub. Is that right?
Alyssa Golub.
Alyssa Golub. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Nobody gets it right.
Who is executive director. We'll be discussing the organization Helping Paws. And she is also joined by executive director Jeff Johnson.
You can't get that wrong.
I know.
It's too easy.
I had to think about that, though. I was like, okay, it is really Jeff Johnson, right?
Too easy.
I know, right? Thank you guys very much for joining. And I did you both deliberately at the same time, because I think sometimes people get different dog groups mixed up. And I think it'd be just a fun compare and contrast to have you both on. So thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
So let's start out. I don't have to say identify yourself with your voice, because it's obviously we have one of each. But can you please give us a brief history on yourselves and how you came to your specific organization?
Go ahead.
So again, I'm Alyssa Golub. I'm the executive director at Helping Paws. I've been at Helping Paws for exactly a year. I've been in the nonprofit industry for over 30 years, all different places, youth work, camps, federated giving organizations, and then somehow, some way, I looked at the right ad at the right time and landed this dream job. So thrilled to be with Helping Paws, 35-year-old organization. We're going into our 35th anniversary right now. Helping Paws' mission is to further people's independence with the use of assistance dogs.
Okay, we will get to more of that.
Okay.
Jeff?
Sure. So I've been at Can Do Canines as executive director for just over 2 years now. So I've been I've been here a little bit longer than Elisa, but not a lot.
And both are babies.
We are, and we both replaced longtime founders. Both of these organizations started at about the same time, and we replaced the founders. My background is just from a totally different world of government and politics and law. I was on the county board for a while and in the Minnesota House, and also practiced law.
Wow.
And so this is Elisa described it as a dream job, and the same thing happened to me. I happened to be looking to do something different at exactly the right time and was in the right place and lucked into this, because it's just an amazing job. Both places are amazing places for
I
us
like
to be.
I like that idea of lucking into it. That's exactly what happened.
So, Jeff, you're kind of one of those valuable, all-encompassing, but scary people to have on the...
Scary.
You know a lot about a lot of things that could be scary.
a little about a lot of things, but when you come from politics, you pretend a lot, so...
Ah, that's right. Can you both just kind of give me a little bit of insight, like what kind of experience you had with the people with disabilities before you came to this? Because this is all about disabilities.
Correct. So throughout my career, whether I worked in camps or I worked in community programming, I always had some part of my job that worked with the area within disabilities. So I had some background going through that. Also, both of my children have disabilities. So that world and the nonprofit world and being in that world was just a really natural space for me to be in.
Jeff?
And for me, setting aside just having some friends who have educated me over the years, my experience has come in the world of politics. So I was on the Hennepin County Board for 11 years, and a big piece of what the board does is fund human services organizations, including organizations that help people with disabilities. So that experience has been invaluable for me in this particular organization.
Thank you. So
interesting background.
I know, isn't it? So now I want you guys to tell me about what each of your organizations do and the different types of dogs that you graduate, like not necessarily breed, but like what do they do with those types of dogs?
Yep.
So we'll rewind and pretend I didn't say it before.
That's okay.
But yes, Helping Paws is 35 years old, and we focus on people with physical disabilities, veterans, and first responders with PTSD. And we've begun some work in the area of facility dogs, whether they be in a courthouse or a rehabilitation center for traumatic brain injuries and things like that. So that is our main core focus, are those three areas.
And at Can-Do Canines, we serve people with five different types of disabilities, people who have mobility issues, which is very broad, people who are deaf or severely hard of hearing, people who have seizures, people who have type 1 diabetes, and children with autism. And we have also been, at about the same time, starting to move into the area of facility dogs. We've been working with Children's Masonic Hospital and have three dogs placed there, and then are working with Fairview just a bit about maybe placing a couple more, which is a very different model, because instead of serving one person for a long time, they serve lots of people for a short period of time.
Right. Can I ask, like, is a facility dog actually considered a service dog, or are they just like a emotional support type?
They are considered, at least the ones that we are placing right now, are still considered an assistance dog. And if I can just expound on that difference, because a lot of people don't understand the difference between
this. Go for it.
Yeah, so an assistance dog or a service dog, they are somewhat interchangeable, are at a certain level where they have to be trained for physical tasks. They may also do a lot of emotional work, but they are trained for certain physical tasks. And an emotional support dog generally isn't. They still receive some training, but they are more of a little bit more like a companion dog. And so the facility dogs that we place really do serve both purposes. They play a very important emotional support role, especially in a children's hospital, obviously. But they're also taught specific physical tasks to do as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, if I think about our dogs that are working with people, again, in the traumatic brain injury rehabilitation center, some of the things that they're wanting the patients to do that they're kind of reluctant to do, they can bring in that dog and have the dog show them how open the door or, you know, and somehow that dog breaks down. Well, we all know that the dogs break down that barrier and the patient's more willing to be part of their own rehabilitation.
Do you guys overlap at all?
I think we do some, not a lot. I mean, we don't do PTSD. And some of the things that we do, I know Helping Paws doesn't, but you do some mobility issues, do you not?
Yeah, mostly physical, you know, disabilities, being in a wheelchair primarily. But I think what we do really well together is share resources. So there's many times that someone might call for a dog that helps with autism, mm-hmm. and we're super happy to refer them to Can-Do Canine.
Yep.
The most important thing is that the person gets the dog that they need to grow their independence and their quality of life. And at the bottom line, that's living our mission, whether it's referring them to Can-Do Canine or being able to take them on ourselves.
Yeah, we like to do the same thing. And I think there's, in the history of the organizations, maybe there's been a little bit of competition. And we just don't see it that way because there's so much need out there. There are plenty of clients and plenty of support for both of our organizations. So it's kind of fun to work together.
And I presume you both are 501c3s?
Correct.
That's correct.
Can you talk just a small amount of time on how you raise your money?
Go ahead.
So we are supported through individual donations, corporate sponsors, foundations, and grants. All of those donations, all of those beautiful gifts allow us to do the work that we do every day. So we're very grateful to our supporters. And we work a lot now. We're expanding our corporation platform a little bit, really reaching out to kind of have year-long relationships with some of our corporate sponsors. So redesigning that a little bit. But yeah, it's all money from fundraising. I mean, Jeff might be able to speak to this as well, but we know by the time we put all the investment into the dog is, you know, the dog is bred, the puppies are had, the vets are taken, the training, each dog going out our door is worth about $30,000. And for us, that dog is gifted to the client. There's really very minimal cost to the client. We call them a graduate once they leave our training program. Mm-hmm. And so we can't do that. We can't offer that without our donors and supporters.
And we do the same. We rely upon individuals and corporations and foundations. We don't seek government funding save for, you know, the PPP loan or grant was very helpful
right.
during COVID. But otherwise, that's really not part of what we do. And we also give our dogs away free of charge and always want to be able to do that because we don't want that to be a barrier for someone who can't afford a dog. So we're just really appreciative of the generous people who want to help others.
Let's talk puppies. Everyone loves puppies.
Talking about puppies.
Where do they come from?
Yeah, let's talk about.
At least I can answer.
You know where? We know where they come from. Shirley needs to go back to some more biology. We'll deal with
that
later.
That's a whole nother show.
Yeah,
right.
That is a whole nother show. But just talk about how you get your dogs and what you know, how that works.
Yeah, so we at Helping Paws have our own breeding program. We're very proud of that. It has a very strong history. Eileen Bone, who was the founder of Helping Paws, has really been the hands-on person up to her point of retiring in a few weeks, but has been the hands-on person who has really been able to make that breeding program as successful as it is. So what we do is when a litter is born, we usually, if it's the right fit, identify one of the female dogs to become a breeding dog. So they do go through the same program as all the other dogs because we know that that's really important in the traits that mm-hmm. they're learning.
Mm-hmm.
But then they live in a, what we call a caretaker home instead of a foster home. They live in a caretaker home, and they are breeded when they are ready. And they have puppies, and then 8 weeks later, they go into a foster home trainer, and they begin their career to be super pups.
And Jeff, does your organization do the same?
We do. I would say about 80% of our dogs come from our breeding program. And I think the reason both of our organizations, and many do have their own breeding program, is because the success rate is just so much better than a dog that is not purpose-bred to be an assistance dog. And you know, our success rate is around 70%. Some years it's better, and maybe other years it's a little worse. We're also part of an international breeding cooperative, so we will trade either dogs or semen from stud dogs to breed and try to improve every generation, kind of those personality traits that make for a dog that is not just good at being an assistance dog, but gets joy out of working. Because not all dogs,
yes.
I mean, dogs
That's
are like
right.
people. Some
That's
love it,
true.
Some don't.
Yeah.
And we try to rescue a dog or two every year. The success rate is not good, but we still try because we want to.
Right. Trying is good. How old are the puppies when you start the training?
For us, it's 8 weeks. They leave the whelping home, and they, again, we use all foster home, volunteer foster home trainers. So that foster home trainer takes the dog, and lives with the foster home trainer family, whatever was at the house, for 2.5 years, and comes to our facility once a week to work with our professional trainers. And that's the puppy's mom and dad for those 2.5 years.
Ours is a little different, although similar to that. So we, I think for both of us, the training starts immediately, even when they're a week old, there's little tiny things that you're doing to get them used to whatever it is. But ours, Helping Paws, ours stay in the home for about 5 weeks, but then ours all move to a weaning prison. So we have five prisons eight prisons that we work with. But
I saw Fox 9
had a nice story about that. Yeah, and so we've got three prisons in Wisconsin and four prisons in Minnesota. So that makes seven. I get the number right at some point. And we have weaning prisons. So the moms and the new litter stay in that weaning prison for 5 weeks, and they're weaned off of each other. And then our dogs go one of two paths. One path is just essentially living with volunteers that train them for another, year and a half to 2 years. Or kind of a mix between a prison program and volunteers. And then, again, like Helping Paws, they come in and they live in our facility then for several weeks where our professional trainers figure out what it is they want to do and then train them specifically for an individual.
I did hear about the prison program, and I'm curious to know, did you ever do any statistics like how well the dogs do coming out of the prison program as opposed to the volunteers? Like, is there a bigger success rate from one to the other?
I don't think we've done any sort of actual study, but I think if you talk to any of our staff who's been around for a while, they will tell you the dogs that come out of prison, that spend more time in prison, are more skill trained than the dogs that spend all their time in volunteer homes, because the focus there is on skills. Whereas the focus in the volunteer homes for us, this is a little different, but for us it's more socialization and basic obedience training as opposed to training skills. So we have found that our dogs that that spend more time in prison are, these inmate handlers don't have a lot. They're very focused on doing this, and it's a competitive program to get into. So it's an amazing win-win for us.
And do they get a list of things that the puppy raiser should look for or try to do with them to kind of enhance their skills?
Absolutely. Are you talking about the prison or about volunteers?
Either one.
Well, for both of them, for prison, we have somebody who goes into each prison every week and does in-person training, and then they are, given their tasks for the week to work on. And for our volunteers, they come into our facility every other week to do training with a trainer and then are given the homework, essentially.
Yeah, a little bit different for us. So they do live with the foster home trainer for that whole 2.5 years, and they come to our facility in Hopkins once a week to train with our professional trainers. And we have four parts of our curriculum. So Perfect Puppies is where, oxymoron, but Perfect Puppies are really learning those beginning behavioral traits, knowing their name, things like that. Again, we're going to have an oxymoron here, but then they go to Awesome Adolescence. And then about 6 to 9 months later, they will go to Working Dogs. Working Dogs now is more, they're starting to, both of our facilities are kind of set up like a home or public settings. So, you know, learning how to turn on a light, learning how to open a door. And then they go into what I call Puppy College, which is our big dog program, and they start to do those tasks, those skills, more out in public, on field trips. They're going to Target, they're going to Menards, they're going to all the places to make sure that when they're in public that they're still very, very much focused on the person training them. Mm-hmm. And by the end of all of that, our dogs know about 80 cues by the time they graduate our program.
And I'm wondering how old the dogs are when they're given, let's call them end users. How old are they when they're given to the end user?
Anywhere, for us, it's anywhere to 2, 2.5 years.
It's about the same.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it takes to, you know, be able to train a dog to that skill level. And it just kind of depends, you know. I think I kind of joked with you earlier, Sam, that the female dogs seem to graduate sooner, just like our female humans are a little bit more mature, and the male dogs come a little bit later.
Sorry, Jeff.
It's all right. Yeah. I had two boys. I totally understand.
I have two boys too, so I.
So do I.
Yeah. So it's really about that 2, 2.5 year mark. That we try to make the match, and we can talk about that if you want, how we do the matching and what that all looks like, and how we train the person who gets the dog. But it's right about that 2.5 year mark.
You know, we will talk about that in just a minute. I'm just curious, what do you do with the dog if it doesn't make it? Because there's always some that
don't.
There are, every school will tell you.
Yeah, 30% essentially is kind of where we're at. We're hoping to make that a little bit smaller. But they are given to someone as an amazing pet in our case. So we first offer them to the volunteers who raised them. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of the time they jump at the chance, right, to have this dog as
right.
a pet. But sometimes it doesn't work because they already have dogs or whatever, and then we just have a list online of people who are looking for a dog, and we contact them and say, here's what we have.
Yeah, we pretty much do the same thing. We call it a career change. And that dog, so I can think of one case where it was a foster home trainer. They trained the dog. The dog did, for a variety of reasons why dogs don't make it through the curriculum. But now that dog in the foster home trainer, his wife now takes that dog weekly to hospitals and senior centers and senior homes. 'Cause those dogs want to work, you know, and
right.
we still want them to have a purpose. So, same thing though, the first choice goes to the foster home trainer. Then we have a list, but we do try to find a way for that dog to continue to have a purpose.
All right, let's talk about the match, which is the end game. That's what you want, is a good, successful match. So how's that done?
Go ahead.
So it's pretty remarkable. I will tell you, it was my very first week when I was watching through the window this match happen. And people told me while I was interviewing that, oh, you'll see, Elisa, the dog chooses the person. I'm like, that's absolutely ridiculous. But I watched through the window, and I watched this gentleman who's a veteran meet four different dogs. One dog just sat there. One dog was, you know, distracted. And these are trained, 2.5 year trained dogs. And then comes out dog number three, walks up, does every command, and puts his head on the veteran's lap. So I'm crying. I'm sure everybody else was crying. And a match was made. And the dog absolutely picks its person.
It is. I mean, it is the greatest key to our success. is to find, because not everybody is a match, and not everybody, right. not every dog is a match for that particular person.
We know that.
Yes, I mean, it's just, it's the way it works. And ours is a little bit different. Once our dogs come in for final training, so they've spent that 2 years or so with volunteers and in prison, then they come and live in our facility, and our professional trainers train them and try to figure out at that point first what they love and what they're good at. But then they work with our client services coordinators, which is a different team, and they sit down and actually make that match together. So this is the type of dog I have. This is what he or she is good at and loves to do. Do you have a client that you think would be a good match? And then once that match is made, then they work together with the client to kind of finish that training.
Right. And then we would bring, once that match is made, you know, again, our client, for our folks with physical disabilities, they come to Helping Paws for 3 weeks of kind of a boot camp where we transfer those 80 cues, fine-tune some of them based on that person's need, to the graduate. So that they can take over.
I know that everyone kind of dwells on this, but it is still very close to the fact. And I have to ask, what did you guys do during COVID? Because I know Seeing Eye shut down for a while, which is where my dog comes from.
Well, for us, it was before my time. So I stepped in kind of toward a little bit closer to the end of COVID, but they did. They cleared out our kennels. We usually have 20 to 40 dogs in our kennels in final training at any given time. And because we closed down the building, we had to find foster homes for those, as well as obviously all the, we have about 250 dogs in our system at any time. And so they shut down for, I think, a couple weeks and then opened up in a very, very limited fashion after that. We came back to work full force when we could, which was a year ago or a year and a half ago. It was tough. It was tough for a lot of assistance dog organizations because breeding changes during that period, which affects you 2 years later.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we have felt the effects of that.
100%. I mean, very similar. Again, I came after, but, you know, the dogs were able to stay with their foster home. They did as much training over Zoom as they could, but you can imagine that that doesn't have the same effect as in-person training. You know, so we graduated less dogs, and I think we're both recovering from that. Our waiting lists are very long because of that 2 year, you know, break, that we're trying to catch up from, and be able to continue matching at the same rate and continue breeding at the same rate. And it'll probably take a good another year to really kind of feel like we're in the place that we were 4 or 5 years ago.
There were benefits, though, as we always hear about COVID, right? Yeah. Certain things where you get to eat with your family more often and those sorts of things. But for us, we did online training as well, and that has been a nice supplement to the in-person training, so that if somebody just can't make it on a given week, there's also now videos that I'm sure both of us have that wouldn't have existed if not for being, you know, having to make
learning
them.
Learning on the fly.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, did you extend at any point as far as, like, you almost have an opportunity to do a parallel thing, right? Like, you could do some online trainings via Zoom or whatever, and then also your in-person stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And we do somewhat of a combination there. I think you guys do every week. We do every other week. So sometimes in between, something else would happen online.
Is there anything that has changed? I'm just talking, like, from before,
Charlene,
from before the, you know, where what you guys did as far as how things were before COVID to now. Do you do anything different after?
You know,
protocols or anything like that?
Yeah, from a dog training standpoint, I'm not thinking of anything. Obviously, right. from the volunteer training, there's more flexibility now, I think, for people. We certainly have seen the same changes in the workplace that every workplace has, where you know, people are able to do more work remotely than they used to, depending upon what their job is. So that, I think that's been a plus for a lot of staff members.
Yeah, I would say that that's probably just the same for us. I don't know that our curriculum has changed. We've just been more flexible.
I will add, we had to leave all seven of our prisons during COVID for a long period of time, not for a couple of weeks. And that was difficult because not only did we need to, we had to find volunteers for all the dogs that were in the kennel, but we also had to find volunteers for all the dogs that were in all seven of those prisons. And we actually got back in the last prison in Rochester, you know, a few months ago. So we're back in all of them again, but it was, that was tough.
That would be tough.
How many dogs go into the prison system?
You know, I don't know the total number. Usually it's probably 10 to 15 at a time in each of them. And so, you know, they go in little waves. But, it, you know, it's quite a few dogs that go through that program.
I could imagine that this would improve a prisoner's outlook and behavior, having to train the dog.
We hear that a lot from, I mean, the prisons that we're in, when you talk to the warden there or other staff there, they will say, many of them will say, you know, we weren't sure because it's more work, right, to have a dog program in the prison, and they have a separate wing for it in every case. But every one of them have said that it fundamentally changes these guys and gals. We're in a woman's prison and then six male prisons, and when we talk to the inmates, I try to visit on occasion, and it is, you know, a lot of them are in for a long, long time because they did something really bad, and I've had multiple of them say this is a little bit of tiny bit of redemption for me, or this is the only meaningful thing I have in my life right now. So it's pretty cool because it's a huge help for us. It's important for our clients, but it's actually probably positive for them as well.
Are there other dog training around the country that do prison?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of the larger schools do prison programs. In fact, I mean, I think it started back in the 80s or 90s. I think a nun founded it somewhere out on the East Coast that had a school and started moving into the prisons, and it's become pretty popular.
You had a couple other questions, didn't you, Charlene?
I do, and one of them is, when you need to get new trainers and people retire or just move on, where do you get them?
I mean, I think that, you know, for our trainers, that group of people, they have their inner circles, you know. When we need trainers, they're able to reach out to their colleagues and the people that they surround themselves with. And it's not as hard to get a trainer. I used to think it was, but I was told it's not that hard to get a trainer. And, you know, this type of work is pretty positive. I mean, I'll get resumes all the time saying, I used to be a veterinarian, but now I just need to do something good. You know, can I work at Helping Paws? And I would love to take all of them. But there does seem to be kind of that career change thing that happens as well. And we do get a lot of people who have worked in the animal industry in some way or another, but really feel that they need to rejuvenate, and Helping Paws is a great place to do that.
Yeah, I kind of see it the same way. It's interesting the different avenues that trainers will come from, because it's not all that often that a trainer from a different school will come and work for us. It does happen once in a while, but more it's somebody who has experience with dogs, but it's maybe a little bit different. There's also, you know, there are a couple of colleges out there that teach dog training. And we recently hired somebody from one of them. So there's a lot of different ways people can get to us. But I would agree, when we've had openings, that has been less difficult to fill than some of the other openings we've had.
Definitely.
I'm wondering if the end user, I don't know why I like that term so much.
It works.
Sure.
If they get any type of certificate or anything from you that legitimizes that this is a service dog?
Yeah, so they do get a public access certifications, so that they, public access card that allows them to have that dog with, in our case, blue coat, red coat, blue coat out in public. And we do move that dog, you know, under their care, under their name.
Same. We have an ID, essentially a certificate, and we just, you probably did too, just switched over to a digital ID through the international organization, which is wonderful because it's always on your phone now. So that's essentially what they get.
And we continue throughout the life of the dog to do public access testing, even with when the dog is placed. We're very involved with the dog even after it goes to the graduate in what the dog is doing, the health of the dog, tweaking any cues that need to happen. But they do have to do, and I'm going to forget how often, and if any of my staff is listening, they're going, Alisa, but they do have to get recertified with that public access every, I don't know if it's yearly, but it's certainly, they have to renew that.
Yep, same.
You're saying the staff does or the end user does?
They have to take a public access test through us.
The client does.
Yeah. The client, okay.
The end user, yep.
Interesting.
That's interesting. So,
well, this would...
Go ahead.
With this certificate, are they running into problems like flying? And because I know I have had some issues, you know, the paperwork to fly with your service dog and all that.
Hey, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, yes, I think there mm-hmm. there obviously you've maybe had some experience with that, and I'm part of a committee through Assistance Dogs International, which we are both organizations are members of. Where we've been working to try to make all the application processes across the airlines the same. So
yes.
Once you do it once.
You're working on that?
We're working on it, but it's easier said than done. Because
right.
understandably, every company's going to want to have their own little twist on things. But that's the ultimate goal. There was also, this same committee was also a big push to limit what airlines have to do with respect to service animals versus emotional support animals, because people were bringing their emotional support birds on.
Don't get us started.
That's done. Right.
That's
right.
Done.
That
it muddied the
solved.
Waters
yes.
and it made the, you know, the red
yes.
tape harder
that's right.
for our certified assistance dogs.
I still feel that emotional support dogs muddy the waters.
I think they do sometimes. I think that's
yeah,
right.
I think they do a lot of times. Yep. But we can, that's a whole nother show.
Whole nother show.
I'm fairly. But
it's important to understand the difference. And,
yes.
And it's important
and
for the community
difference.
To understand the difference. And
right.
it's important for our stores and our vendors and our public spaces to understand the difference between, you know, the law and ADA requirements and laws and what's okay and what's not okay, and you know, not to turn people away.
It is unfortunate, I feel, that the GP, general public, is only allowed to ask two questions. I actually would welcome some amount of idea that they did understand that this is a service dog,
mm-hmm.
because it really gets difficult when Fifi pops out of the purse and, you know, starts going crazy or doing whatever. And then I'm having to say she shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So it does get difficult. And I feel like it spoils it in a way. And it makes it harder for the store owners because they are afraid to ask anything.
Yeah. Right.
Because that. They're afraid of getting in trouble.
I think that's interesting that you, as someone with a service dog or a guide dog, that your preference would be that people could ask more questions just to make it more clear what really is a service dog versus otherwise.
So I was talking to Alisa earlier, and people sometimes call me a cynic, and I try to say that I'm a realist. But I have an ID for my dog. I'm okay if somebody says, would you mind if I looked at your dog's ID? And that is fine.
Yeah,
if that would keep all the other wishers that I could have my buddy with me out,
that
would be so more than worth it to me.
Yeah,
it is not about, to me, it's not about an invasion of privacy. It's not about a none of your business. It's about making things clear
and safe.
So people, and safe.
Yeah.
for
it's
you
about education,
and your user.
Yes,
right? That too.
It's about education. It's about, you know, being able to have shows like this and being able for, you know, people like Jeff and I to go around and really educate the public so that there is an understanding. And there's a place for an emotional support animal, and, you know, that's fine. But there is a difference, and, you know, the importance of that difference, I guess, is important. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how people can get involved with your web, with your organization, and maybe the website?
Sure. Lots of ways to get in. And it is, 2.5 years is a long time, but I'll always remember I went out with one of our foster home trainers on my second or third day, and I did say, how do you do it? And she's on her fourth dog. And she said her mantra is every day, I want the dog, but someone else needs the dog.
Aww,
and I remember every day. And when we coach our foster home trainers into making that decision, we try to help them remember that.
And for anybody who's listening and who says, I don't know if I could do that, remember that that's one dog you place with somebody who's really getting what they need. Then you can do another one, you know, and you can love that one. And I don't know. It seems like I sometimes think that in a way is easier than watching them die.
Every 2.5 years. I call it a car lease. You too can get a puppy every 2.5 years.
That's funny.
I do hear that from volunteers a lot, because I'll ask the same question. You know, it's pretty hard to bring the dog back, right? Because it's a tough day.
Yeah.
But they say then I go to graduation and I meet the person's life that I helped change. Right. And I say, I got to do this again. So it's pretty cool. They're special people.
They are special people. Selfless is the way, you know, like I said at the beginning, I've been in the nonprofit world for 30 years. I've worked with a lot of volunteers. This is the most selfless group of volunteers that I've ever encountered in my career.
I wonder, I am curious to know, at least with my school, there are some things that they ask the puppy raisers to kind of pay attention to and to discourage, because, you know, whatever the dog does, be it bad or good, we get stuck with that at the end. So I always tell anybody I talk with who's going to raise one for guiding, please, please, please follow the rules, because whatever you don't follow, I'm stuck with.
That's a great message to put out there. Yeah.
I wonder, are there anything that you encourage people to discourage the dog to do? For instance, we generally don't like our dogs on furniture.
Yeah, that's now, probably rule one. Yes.
What if you as an owner decide, the end user, you're going to break that? That's your deal. But you don't know who, you know, the person that you're giving that dog to, you don't know what their living circumstances, and they may not be able to have that happen. Or may not want that to happen.
Right. So. Yeah, those are probably very similar. That they're pretty strict rules about that. Whether it's, you know, dogs cannot be on when you are either puppy sitting or raising, they can't be on the furniture, because that might be the case with the graduate in the end. They don't get to sleep in the bed. They have to be in their kennel whenever you are not home or when you're sleeping. And again, your graduate in the end might not want to do any of those things, and they might be perfectly comfortable with the dog sleeping with them. But that's an easy problem to fix. The other way around is impossible.
Harder. Yeah.
Careful for the mic.
Sorry about that.
I'm going to turn you off. that's their call and what they do. And I think that the other thing is car seats, right? So I know Charlene does some of it, but I take a lot of cabs. We have enough drivers who are very sensitive to my dog getting on their seat. And actually the ADA does state 4 on the floor. And so I'm wondering, do you guys, is that anywhere in your?
Yeah, we train for, you know, that, especially with travel in the car. We have also a really great program with the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport to teach those skills and boarding a plane and being on a plane. Those rules are, like Jeff said, easier to break the rule at the end than have to train for the rule.
at the end.
Elisa mentioned the Flight to Nowhere, which is MSP, which is, it's absolutely amazing. And there is no other airport in the United States that does it to the degree that MSP does. We actually get to clients and trainers, volunteers, get to bring the dogs in. They go through security. They get on the tram. They get on an actual, inside an actual plane, and get under the seat and just get practice at that, because
really?
It's a scary thing
really,
for a dog.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable. It was really the person who is in charge of inclusivity at Minneapolis St. Paul Airport wants to be the most, and I'm going to forget
wow.
his name, and that is so terrible.
That's cool.
But he wants our airport to be the most inclusive airport in the country. This was one of his projects, to take an old Delta plane. They brought it mm-hmm. from, it wasn't here, they brought it from somewhere, carved it out so that it can be a training plane. And I know they also do it, I mean, they do it with our dogs, but they also do it for kids with autism who might need to practice getting on a flight, you know, a week before their flight, so that they really understand the order of things. It is an incredible service that our airport does for our community.
And how many times does that, like, in any particular dog get to go through that?
I think ours just do it once, generally. You could probably do it more than once.
Yeah. I mean,
I could see the benefit of that.
Yeah. I know one of our trainers sets it up once a month on a Saturday, and I think, you know, to get all our classes through, because we have about 65, 70 dogs in training at any given time. So, and I think, I'm not sure that she does it by class. I think she does it by availability. So I think you don't have to be in the class to go on that day, but at least to do it once.
Well, that's cool. You're saying our airport is the only one that does that?
Not the only one, but they certainly do it. Yeah, they do it better than anyone else.
Of course. You know.
Of course.
We are a very generous state. We are.
You know, we're talking about dogs, so I'm kind of jealous. I realize that must be such a good way to get funds. I think we're going to adopt like a pet lemur or something. Maybe we'll...
That's a great idea.
I'll tell KFAI they should do that. I'm wondering... and. What happens, and we deal with this too, what happens when your dog retires? Are they allowed to keep them and still have another dog that will be in their working time? Do they have to give them up? How do you work with that?
I can start.
Yeah.
I mean, we probably do it the same way, I'm guessing. But yes, they can absolutely keep them, and we transfer ownership after a year if the client chooses to do that. So they would own the dog at that point. There are some situations, though, where it probably wouldn't work because
right.
the existing dog, it might be time for that dog to retire, but he or she is not ready to retire. Mm. And so having the new dog come in,
dogs have
and
a tendency
work,
to tell you if they're
yeah.
going to retire
so,
or not.
I mean, we would, if the client wanted to keep the dog who was retired, we would have to do some work to make sure it was going to
that
practically work. If the dog passes away, which sometimes happens, obviously, for us at least, that client moves to the top of the list for a successor dog.
We have a successor dog. Yep.
And I don't think we mentioned like what breeds of dogs you guys use.
Go ahead. Let me start.
So we use Goldens and Labs. That's what we breed. We breed Goldens and Labs. Some people ask why. Well, Goldens and Labs are retrievers. So a lot of the work we need them to do is retrieving. And this part, some people don't like to hear this, but it is the truth. Goldens and Labs have a greater ability to transfer affection than some breeds.
I believe
owners
that.
Don't want to hear that. But
nope,
anyone who's going to pet them and feed them and treat them
yep.
and love them, they're able to move that affection. And that makes the whole process
this
just
is
much
why
easier.
I'm a shepherd girl.
Yes.
But, do you ever do a cross?
We do not at Helping Paws.
Okay.
We do. So all of our breeding program is labs or lab mixes. So we do some a lot of lab golden mixes. We've done a few lab Newfoundland mixes and a couple others. And then we don't breed standard poodles. We do use standard poodles for clients that have allergies because,
right.
of course, labs and goldens shed something fierce, and poodles don't. And so that's helpful.
Are you thinking of doing anything with that whole doodle thing?
Probably not. They probably don't have quite the right
temperament.
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And it, you know, the Elisa mentioned the transfer of affection. That is a really important part of our breeding program, because
both
of those dogs are good at that, and that's what you want. You know, if a dog has spent 2.5 years with a family,
that's true.
A lot of dogs wouldn't be able to
handle
cope.
That. And like our school would tell us, you got to remember that dogs have like 3 big bonds they break. They break the bond with their mother, they break the bond with their puppy raiser, and then if you give them up, they break the bond with you. So that's true. I get that. Real quick, what would you guys like to see for the future of your organizations besides that they go on forever?
Going on forever is great. You know, for us, we're ready to grow. We're ready to, you know, look into bigger sites, be able to bring in more dogs. My statement with my staff is always more dogs, more impact. So the ability to grow, the ability to have space, you know, to train more dogs, to bring in more trainers, to have more staff, that's my goal. We want to graduate more dogs. We want to change more lives. And I see Helping Paws, we're on the brink of that. That's the next phase for us. The next 3 to 5 years, I think we're going to see a bigger Helping Paws, and I'm really excited about that.
Jeff?
I'd say the same thing, and there's room for both of us to grow because there's so much need out there. So I would love to see both of our organizations
100%.
Grow.
100%, and we do different things.
We do. So we're looking at, we will probably graduate 52 teams this year, and we're looking at where we want to be in 2030, which will be some number larger than that, and then also probably either build or buy a second building so we can start whelping in-house rather than solely using volunteers for that.
Well, we really do appreciate you guys coming on. It's always nice to have furry-friendly animal friends here and friends of furry-friendly animals. So thank you, and I know there's a huge need for, and if it's anything like our schools, you guys have a fairly large line waiting to be served.
We do.
So,
thank us for giving us the time. This was really important.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate being here.
Can you give your websites one more time? Jeff, I don't think you gave yours.
CanDoCanines.org.
HelpingPaws.org.
Ah, see? Easy peasy. And people can call and talk to you guys if they want, or email
you guys. Absolutely. Call away, emails, go on Facebook and send us a message. And we're all of that, too. Follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on all the things that I'm too old to understand, but that my marketing guy does a great job with.
Well, and I encourage, if somebody is or knows somebody who they think might be helped by an assistance dog, call and just ask.
Absolutely.
I think either organization is happy to talk with you about that. A lot of people don't think they would qualify, and they would, and the dog could change their life.
Well, a 100%. Lot of people think they have to pay a lot of money.
Right. And that's not true of either of our organizations.
There's some mysteries about it, so we'll help you solve those mysteries by just giving us a call.
Thanks for being on, guys.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. I almost said it with Charlene. Wow, I'm really having issues tonight. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Aaron is my podcaster. I want to encourage you, if you want to be on the listener member support list, to give us your name and we will announce it. Tonight's was Kurt Johnson from Battle Lake, Minnesota. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. Our email is disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. Thanks so much for listening. See ya.
KFAI.org.